The abbot presented his gift, and with one last despairing glance at Nicholas, Royan faced the inevitable. She closed her eyes and opened her mouth. To roars of encouragement and the urgings of fife and drum, she struggled and chewed. Her face turned rosy and her eyes watered. At one point, Nicholas thought she was going to have to admit defeat and spit it out onto the reed-covered floor. But slowly and courageously, a bit at a time, she forced it down and then fell back exhausted. Her audience, clapping and hooting, loved every moment of it. The abbot sank stiffly to his knees in front of her and embraced her, almost losing his crown in the process. Then, without relinquishing his embrace, he made himself a place beside her. "It looks as though you've made another conquest," Nicholas told her dryly. "I think he'll be on your lap at any moment, if you don't duck and run." Royan reacted swiftly. She reached across and grabbed a bottle of Katikala and a bowl which she filled to the brim. "Drink it up, Pops," she told him, and held the bowl to his lips. Jarly Hora accepted the challenge, but he had to release her to drink from her hand. Suddenly, Royan started so violently that she spilled what was left in the bowl down the old man's robe. The blood drained from her face, and she began to tremble, as though in a high fever, as she stared at Jarly Hora's crown, which had slipped forward over his eyes. "What is it?" Nicholas demanded quietly but urgently, and he reached across to steady her with a hand on her arm. Nobody else in the chamber had noticed her distress, but he was fully attuned to her moods by now. Still staring, ashen-faced at the crown, she dropped the bowl and reached down and grasped his wrist. He was startled by her strength. Her grip was painful, and he saw that she had driven her nails into his flesh so hard that she had broken the skin. "Look at his crown! The jewel! The blue jewel!" she gasped. He saw it then, amongst the gaudy shards of glass and pebbles of semi-precious garnets and rock crystal. The size of a silver dollar. It was a seal of blue ceramic, perfectly round, and baked to a hard, impervious finish. In the centre of the disc was an etching of an Egyptian war chariot, and above it the distinctive and unmistakable outline of the hawk with the broken wing. Around the circumference was a legend engraved in hieroglyphics. It took him only a few moments to read it to himself. "I command 10,000 chariots. I am Taita, Master of the Royal Horse." Royan desperately wanted to escape from the oppressive atmosphere of the cavern. The parcel of what that the abbot had forced upon her had mixed heavily with the few mouthfuls of tedge she had swallowed, and this feeling in turn was aggravated by the smell of the dirty food bowls thick with congealing grease and the fumes of raw katikala. Already some of the monks were puking drunk, and the smell of vomit added to the cloying miasma of incense smoke within the chamber. However, she was still the centre of the abbot's attention. He sat beside her, stroking her bare arm and reciting garbled extracts from Amharic scriptures. Tess A. had long ago given up translating for her. Royan looked hopefully at Nicholas, but he was withdrawn and silent, seeming oblivious of his surroundings. She knew that he was thinking about the ceramic seal in the abbot's crown, for his eyes kept returning thoughtfully to it. She wanted to be alone with him to discuss this extraordinary discovery. Her excitement outweighed the distress of her overloaded stomach. She felt her cheeks flushed with it. Every time she looked up at the old man's crown, her heart fluttered, and she had to make an effort to stop herself reaching up, seizing the shiny blue seal and ripping it from its setting to examine it more closely. She knew how unwise it was to draw attention to the scrap of ceramic, but when she glanced across the circle, she saw that Boris was far past noticing anything other than the bowl of katikala in his hand. In the end, it was Boris who gave her the excuse for which she had been seeking. He tried to get to his feet, but his legs collapsed under him. He sagged forward quite gracefully, and his face dropped into the bowl of grease-sodden injera bread. He lay there snoring noisily, and Tessé appealed to Nicholas. "Alto, Nicholas, what am I to do?" Nicholas considered the unlovely spectacle of the prostrate hunter. There were scraps of bread and beef stew sticking like confetti in his cropped ginger hair. "I rather suspect Prince Charming has had enough for one night," he murmured. He stood up, stooped over Boris, and gripped one wrist. With a sudden jerk, he lifted him into a sitting position and then heaved him upright and over his shoulder in a fireman's lift. "Good night, all," he told the assembled monks, very few of whom were in any condition to respond. Then he carried Boris away, draped over his shoulders, with head and feet dangling. The two women had to hurry to keep up with Nicholas as he strode down the terrace and then up the stone stairway without a pause. "I did not realize Alter Nicholas was so strong," Tessé panted, "for the stairs were steep and the pace was hard." "I didn't either," Ryan admitted. She experienced a ridiculous proprietary pride in his feat and smiled at herself in the darkness as they approached the camp. "Don't be silly," she admonished herself. "He isn't yours to boast about." Nicholas threw his burden down on Boris's own bed in the thatched hut and stood back panting heavily, the sweat trickling down his cheeks.
"Oh, that's a pretty good recipe for a heart attack," he gasped.
Boris groaned, rolled over, and vomited copiously over his pillows and bed linen. "On that pleasant note, I will bid you all good night and sweet dreams," Nicholas told Tessé, stepping out of the hut into the warm African night. He breathed in the smell of the forest and the river with relief, and then turned to Royan as she gripped his arm.
"Did you see?"
she burst out excitedly. But he laid his fingers on her lips to silence her, and with a cautionary frown in the direction of Boris's hut, led her away to her own hut.
"Did you see it?"
she demanded, unable to contain herself longer. "Could you read it?" "I command 10,000 chariots," he recited.
"I am Taita, master of the royal horse," she completed it for him. "He was here. Oh, Nicky, he was here. Taita was here. That's the proof we wanted. Now we know that we are not wasting our time."
She flopped down on her camp bed and hugged herself ecstatically. "Do you think the abbot will let us examine the seal?" He shook his head. "My guess is no. The crown is one of the monastery treasures. Even for you, his favourite lady, I don't think he'd do it. Anyway, it would not be wise to show any great interest in it. Jali Hora obviously does not have any idea of its significance. Apart from that, we don't want to alert Boris."
"I suppose you're right." She moved over on the bed to make room for him. "Sit down."
He sat down beside her, and she asked, "Where do you suppose the seal came from? Who found it? Where and when?" "Steady on, dear girl. That's four questions in one, and I don't have any answer to any of them."
"Guess," she invited him. "Speculate. Throw some ideas around."
"Very well," he agreed. "The seal was manufactured in Hong Kong. There is a little factory there that turns them out by the thousands. Jali Hora bought it from a souvenir store in Luxor when he was on holiday in Egypt last month." She punched his arm hard.
"Oh, be serious," she ordered.
"Let's hear if you can do better," he invited her, rubbing his arm.
"Okay, here I go.
Taita dropped the seal here in the gorge while he was working on the construction of Pharaoh's tomb. 3,000 years later, an old monk, one of the very first to live here at the monastery, picked it up. Of course, he could not read the hieroglyphics. He took it to the abbot, who declared it to be a relic of St. Frumentius, and had it set in the crown. And they all lived happily ever after," Nicholas agreed. "Not a bad shot." "Can you find any holes?" she demanded. And he shook his head. "Then you agree that this proves that Taita really was here? And that it proves our theories are correct?"
"Proves is too strong a word. Let's just say that it points in that direction," he demurred.
She wriggled around on the bed to face him squarely.
"Oh, Nicky, I am so excited. I swear I'll not be able to sleep a wink tonight. I just can't wait for tomorrow to get out there and start searching again."
Her eyes were bright, and her cheeks flushed a warm rosy brown. Her lips were parted, and he could see the pink tip of her tongue between them. And this time he could not stop himself. He leaned very slowly towards her, treating her gently, giving her every opportunity to pull away if she wished to avoid him. She did not move, but her shining expression turned slowly to one of apprehension. She stared into his eyes as if seeking something, some reassurance. When their lips were an inch apart, Nicholas stopped. And it was she who made the last movement. She brought their mouths together. At first it was soft, just a light mingling of their breath,
and then it became harsher, more urgent. For a long, heart-stopping moment, they devoured each other, and her mouth tasted soft and sweet as ripe fruit. Then suddenly she whimpered, and with a huge effort of will tore herself out of his arms. They stared at each other, both of them shaken and confused.
"No," she whispered. "Please, Nicky. Not yet. I'm not ready."
He picked up her hand and turned it between his palms. Then lightly he kissed the tips of her fingers, savouring the smell and taste of her skin. "I'll see you in the morning." He dropped her hand and stood up. "Early. Be ready," he said, and stooped out through the doorway of the hut. As he was dressing the next morning, he heard her moving around in her hut, and when he whistled softly at her door, she stepped out to meet him, dressed and eager to start. "Boris is not awake yet," Tessé told them, as she served their breakfast. "Now that is a great surprise to me," Nicholas said, without looking up from his plate. He and Rayanne were still slightly awkward in each other's presence, remembering the circumstances in which they had parted the previous evening. However, as Nicholas slung the rifle and the pack over his shoulder and they set off up the valley, their mood changed to one of anticipation. They'd been gone for an hour when Nicholas glanced over his shoulder and then cautioned her with a frown. "We're being followed." Taking her wrist, he drew her behind a slab of sandstone. He flattened himself against the rock and gestured at her to do the same. Then he poised himself and suddenly leapt forward to seize the lanky figure in a dirty white shama who was sneaking up the valley behind them. With a howl, the creature fell to his knees and began gibbering with terror. Nicholas hauled him to his feet. "Tumri, what are you doing following us? Who sent you?" he demanded in Arabic. The boy rolled his eyes towards Royan. "No, please, Effendi, do not hurt me. I meant no harm." "Leave the child, Nicky. You will precipitate another fit," Royan intervened. Tamri scurried behind her and clung to her hand for protection, peering out around her shoulder at Nicholas, as though his life were in danger. "Peace, Tamri," Nicholas soothed him. "I will not hurt you, unless you lie to me. If you do, then I will thrash you until there is no skin on your back. Who sent you to follow us?"
"I came alone. Nobody sent me," blubbered the boy. "I came to show you where I saw the holy animal with the finger marks of the Baptist on his skin."
Nicholas stared at him for a moment before he began to laugh softly.
"I'll be damned if the boy doesn't really believe he saw great-grandfather's dictic." Then he scowled ferociously. "Remember what will happen to you if you are lying."
"It is true, Effendi," Tumri sobbed.
And Royan came to his defence.
"Don't badger him. He's harmless. Leave the poor child."
"All right, Tamri, I'll give you a chance. Take us to where you saw the holy animal."
Tamri would not relinquish his grip on Royan's hand. He clung to it as he danced beside her, leading her along, and within 100 yards his terror had faded, and he was smiling and giggling at her shyly. For an hour he led them away from the Dandera River and up over the high ground above the valley, into an area of thick scrub and upthrust ridges of weathered limestone. The thorny branches of the bush were densely intertwined and grew so close to the ground that there seemed to be no way through them. However, Tumri led them on to a narrow, twisting path, just wide enough for them to avoid the red-tipped hook thorns on each side of them. Then, abruptly, he stopped and pulled Royan to halt beside him. He pointed down, almost at his own toes.
"The river," he announced importantly.
Nicholas came up beside them and whistled softly with surprise. Tamri had led them around in a wide circle to the west, and then brought them back to the Dandera River at a point where it still ran in the bed of the deep ravine. Now they stood on the very edge of the chasm. He saw at once that although the top of the rocky ravine was less than 100 feet wide, the chasm opened out below the rim. From the surface of the water, far below, the rock wall belled out in the shape of one of the pottery Tej flasks. It narrowed again as it neared the top where they stood.
"I saw the holy thing over there,"
Tamri pointed to the far side of the chasm, where a small feeder spring meandered out of the thorny bush. Streamers of bright green moss, nourished by the spring, hung from the lip of the concave rock wall, and the water trickled down them and dripped from the tips into the river 200 feet below.